Katie.
I'm Erica.
And this is Book Talk.
Hi, Katie.
Hi, Erica.
Welcome to Book Talk, your weekly podcast book club. This is a special one-off episode about when we were bright and beautiful. This episode deals with some heavy subject matter because the book deals with some heavy subject matter. So just so you know, content warnings, trigger warnings abound. We will put those in the show notes for you. And you could also Google what the trigger warnings are for this book, and that will be relevant to the discussion. So take care when listening to this episode. Or don't listen to it, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.
But stick around for an interview in the second half of the episode as well. So I'm going to quickly summarize what we read in this book. Cassie Quinn may only be 23, but she knows a few things. One, money cannot buy happiness, but it's certainly better to have it. Two, family matters most. And three, her brother Billy is not a rapist. When Billy, a junior at Princeton, is arrested for assaulting his ex-girlfriend, Cassie races home to Manhattan to join forces with her family. And the Quinns scramble to hire the best legal minds that money can buy. But Billy fits the all too familiar sex offender profile. He's white, athletic, and privileged. That makes headlines and sways juries. Meanwhile, Cassie struggles to understand why Billy's ex would go this far, even if the breakup was painful. And she knows how the first love can destroy someone. Her own years-long affair with a powerful, charismatic man left her shattered, and she's only recently regained her footing. As reporters converge outside their Upper East Side landmark building, the Quinns gird themselves for a media-saturated trial, and Cassie vows she'll do whatever it takes to save Billy. But what if that means exposing her own darkest secrets to the world?
Dun, dun, dun.
I was going to do it, but I thought you would yell at me.
What dun, dun, dun. A book. Okay, so let's go back to how we came to find this book. So you read it first. Did you get it through Book of the Month?
Yes, I think I got this book through Book of the Month. I think I just randomly selected it because they give you five of it. And I was in the mood for a thriller, which it was. I read it randomly and then immediately I was like, I need other people to read this book because I need to talk about my worldview of it and what I'm thinking. But I also need to make sure that that's grounded in reality and what's happening. I just needed a sounding board, I think, because there's a lot of heavy subject matter in this book. It's a very nuanced and complicated and messy discussion in general in society. And I felt like I really needed to talk to someone else about this book. So then I was like, okay, everyone read this book and tell me what your thoughts are, including you.
And that's how we got to here. Although I do think we talked about this book on a previous episode in Book Talk when you talked about your feelings about it. And I remember Googling it or being kind of aware of the controversy around this book on Goodreads.
Now that you're mentioning that, some controversy.
Right. Now that you're mentioning that it was in Book of the Month, I wonder if that is part of what has driven the issues that people have with this book on Goodreads, because I think people did what you did, which is like, oh, a thriller, interesting, and really kind of went into it without knowing what the book was about. Or just it kind of got the book into a bigger audience. And I think authors who write heavier books deal with this, where like there is an audience for your book. How big that audience is, I don't really know. And what happens when it gets outside of the audience? And how do people who don't normally read a book like this kind of react to it?
I think it's hard too, because this is the first time I've ever heard of Jillian Medoff. So like, I thought she was a debut author. I thought this was her first book. A lot of Book of the Month authors are. She is not. She's written multiple books before. So I wonder also what the controversy had to do with her maybe going outside of what she normally writes. And this is, again, the only one I've ever read by her that she has written. But I wonder if that's something to do with it too. I also think this is a hotly debated subject that's really hard to talk about. I think there are only a couple people in my life who I'm like, here's my real opinions about this, or here's my real like thing I'm struggling with about this. Here's something I'm not quite sure I agree with that all of, you know, people I follow or people I talk to maybe agree with. I'm not sure where I fit. And I feel like it's just one of those kinds of conversations. It's really hard, maybe not really hard, but rarer, I think, to have a safe space to have those conversations and questions too. And maybe Book of the Month is not it.
So obviously this book is about a rape trial and an accusation of rape. So that is obviously one of the very heavy topics at the center of this book. And the other challenging part is that right away we know we're not on the side of the accuser, the victim, or the survivor. We are on the side of the accused. And I can see where you might think in the beginning that this is a sympathetic portrayal of Billy, who is the main character, Cassie's brother, half-brother, adopted brother. She's not formally adopted into the family, but she's essentially grown up with him as her brother. Now, I never read the book thinking that Billy was innocent or that anyone actually believed he was innocent in the family.
I agree. I think for 5 seconds I thought that when Cassie first came home and hadn't heard the story. Same as Cassie, right? She hears Billy's been wrongfully accused and she's like, no way. And she gets home and she starts hearing it and she's like, okay, what? And you do it with her. Like, I feel like after that initial reaction where her gut feeling is to defend her brother, which I get, right? She's like, no, he would never do that. And as soon as she starts to uncover it, at that point, I was like, Billy is 100% guilty. And I don't think for a second he fooled anyone. I mean, I went through that whole trial being like, he is going to, whether he is, no matter how he is found guilty or innocent, like, he is guilty. He did this. It's just, you know, who can tell the better story and where is he going to come out and how will his wealth impact that?
Yeah, I think part of the strong reactions to this book comes from different assumptions that we have going into it. And my assumption was that Jillian was critiquing this whole situation, which is people, mostly men, get away with committing sexual assault all the time. And how does that happen? And what is the family structure that enables predators to get away with it and to keep going and to keep victimizing again and again? And how does that sort of ripple out through the people they interact with?
And I think it's also a questioning of how does the larger societal structure allow for this to happen? How do we as a society create this situation in which people like Billy go free in a courtroom with evidence the way that this is played out? Because I think if, you know, he would have been found guilty and thrown in jail, sure, that might have been a little bit more satisfying at the end, but it wouldn't be realistic. That's not what happens to people like Billy. And so I think it's a questioning of the entire system that allows for this and that affects Billy. Like, he has trauma too, and he's a human too. And I think there's nuance. I'm not saying what he did was okay or he shouldn't be punished or anything like that, but I think that it's a conversation we have to be willing to have when crimes like this happen. Why did they happen? How do we prevent them from happening? Who is doing them? Like, there's an understanding level that I think she's questioning that people do not want to question or don't want to have that conversation.
I don't even think she's intentionally questioning it. I think that's what has come out of it, is that, oh, you're giving them too much leeway. Oh, you're making excuses for Billy. I think that is happening in the family, but I don't think that Jillian is trying to let him get away with it. I think she's showing, and the reason I liked the book is I think what she's showing is that there are different groups of people who have a vested interest in not knowing what we know, which is that this person has committed violent sexual assault.
Yes.
And the people who have that position are people who are family members or close friends who cannot see their loved one that way. They're motivated to not acknowledge the truth, even if they know it deep down. There's the financial people, so the lawyer, for example, who thinks it's basically irrelevant for his job whether Billy did it or not.
I feel like most lawyers feel that way.
Some lawyers feel that way. I have lawyer friends. We have lawyer friends. They're not all, you know, horrible people. And we also
I didn't mean like that he's a horrible person. I just mean I think that the innocence or guilt of your client, you still have to represent them, maybe, is what I meant by that.
Yes. We still need good defense attorneys.
Yes.
But in this case, he's not a good defense attorney.
Correct. Yes.
And he has financial interests in getting Billy off, and he doesn't care whether he did it or not. The third group that is the most challenging in this book, I think, is people who themselves have been abused, who cannot see themselves as a victim or a survivor, whichever terminology you like. And you hear this all the time. Like, well, I would never put myself in that position. And it's like a defense mechanism to somehow rationalize that what happened to you is not real rape because it was your husband or it was your uncle or it was someone you were dating. And I think that's where I think the book succeeds, is that it's showing you this whole kind of perverse ecosystem. Now, where that is horrible is that it's a horrible, disgusting ecosystem, and all these characters are horrible people. And I totally get why you don't necessarily want to read about it. It's like, yeah, we live it, baby. It's everywhere. Like, why do I want to spend, you know, the hour of free time I have going into this world? I totally get it.
This book does a really good job of shining a magnifying glass on how this situation and this crime affect not only Billy, but every single person around him, his mom, his sister, people who interact with him. He does not exist in a vacuum, even though it's sometimes easy to feel like perpetrators like this do. They exist by themselves and are outcast by themselves.
If we want to address the issue of sexual assault, we have to really understand it. And that means, unfortunately, as a social scientist, like, we need to study these men in more detail. We have to look at what is going on instead of writing people off as like black boxes of demons that we're never going to look at as full humans. And I don't mean that as like look at them as full humans as if it makes it okay, but we have to understand how it happens if we want to solve the problem.
There are people around us every single day who have lived, survived, been a victim of abuse like this. And I feel like the not talking about it, not trying to figure it out, not having these conversations about how did we get to this place in our society, I think just increases the shame around it as well. The shame for the victims, right? Of people who are like, yeah, this happened to me. And the more that we don't talk about it and it's a taboo topic, the less we understand about it. And the more we end up in a victim blaming culture, or in a, well, it's just that guy culture, or it's just that person. And it becomes very individualized instead of a nuanced issue that society at large needs to deal with.
And sometimes you, and I'm just speaking from personal experience, you don't even realize what happened to you until someone else helps you realize. Like when you tell a funny story about a weird hookup and somebody looks at you and it's like, that's not okay. What they did to you is not okay. And you almost need that mirror. And this is sort of where fiction can also come into play to show you when you're looking at it through a character, through a story, that helps you sometimes be able to look at what happened to you. And I'm not necessarily saying that it's this book that would do that, but I think just in general, that's something where fiction and talking about your story and sharing things with other people also can help you understand what happened to you better, because it's not always super straightforward. Okay, we've been dancing around describing exactly what happens at the end of this book, and we're going to start doing that now. So if you haven't read the book, check the show notes and we'll tell you when we start the non-spoiled interview with Jillian and when we start the spoiled section of the interview with Jillian, so you can avoid all the spoilers if you don't want to hear them. Okay, now let's talk about what we're really talking about, Katie.
Right. So as I was saying, it is not always that clear. And I think what this book makes you confront kind of at the very end is this idea of what do we do now? Right. Billy is free. He's going home. Cassie is not well. She has a lot that she's going to have to work through. But this is a family that has to in some way live in society. And as much as we want to be like, okay, bye, Billy, we hate you forever. Maybe he's not in the family anymore or whatever, or not at school. But what do we do with this now? And in society at large, what do we do with it now? And I think it makes you question that at the end, because there's not always this cut and dry decision where somebody's in jail forever and that's it. We all go to therapy and move on. It's not really that simple. Usually sometimes there isn't any justice that comes out of it, but you still have to confront it in some way. And I don't know that it answers that question, but it kind of asks that question of like, how do people continue to live after something like this?
Well, and we realize that the full scope of justice, even if Billy was guilty, the full scope of justice would not be served, because we have Billy and her other brother who also knew what was going on, or it's at least insinuated that he knew what was going on. Eleanor, who should have been protecting her, who sort of sells her out and sells her story out to get her son off, fine. You know, she is forces Cassie to do things against her will. Anyway, Eleanor, horrible character. So it's like, even in an ideal world where Billy goes to prison, Lawrence goes to prison, Cassie somehow gets herself out of all this trauma, goes to therapy, gets her PhD, there's still so many victims or so many perpetrators who are not going to see justice. I'm mostly thinking of Eleanor in this case.
And also, what even is justice in this case? Because we can't take away Cassie's trauma. We can't take away what happened to Diana. Is there anything? I mean, there is justice that could be served, but at the end of the day, it's not going to be enough. It is never going to be enough because you can't take back what happened to Cassie and Diana.
Exactly. Now, the other big twist that comes is that we find out that Cassie is the one who has also been abused, and she's specifically been groomed and abused by Lawrence, who was her sort of father figure. Did you see that Lawrence was Marcus? Did you see that coming, or was that totally a shock to you?
I read this book pretty quickly, so I think that in the back of my mind, I was like, Marcus is somebody that she knows. I don't know that I really thought it was Lawrence, but I also was not like pausing to think through the book per usual. So I think I was pretty shocked and it was Lawrence, but I knew it was somebody that Cassie knew. I think from the very beginning, I was like, Marcus is somebody that's close to her, maybe a nickname, maybe somebody she's not supposed to admit that she's seeing. I didn't exactly think that it was Lawrence. I thought it was maybe one of his friends, but I knew there was somebody close who was not Marcus. Did you know that it was, or who was not Lawrence? Sorry. Did you know that it was him the whole time?
Definitely not. I have heard people say that on a second read, it's much more obvious. Mm. I think it's obvious that Marcus is a character. You're like, okay, this isn't just some random guy. It's either right. her friend's dad, it's yes. her brother, it's, I don't know, but he's around. But it's interesting talking to Jillian, which we've recorded this interview before, even though it's airing after this in time. It was interesting to hear that Jillian wanted that reveal to be earlier, and her editor asked her to put it later. And I do think part of the challenge with this book is you really have to get through the whole thing. And I think a lot of people can't get through the whole thing. Like, you really have to go all the way to the end to get it and to understand why Cassie is so unreliable, why this family is so fucking weird, why her brothers mm-hmm. suffer with porn addiction, why, you know, there's just all this weird stuff going on with this group. And it takes a long time to figure out what it is. And I kind of wish that that came earlier, because then you realize, oh, okay, Cassie's full of shit. She's lying to herself. Totally understandable. But yep. there's clearly like a lot more nefariousness in this specific family that makes all this stuff that's going on make a lot more sense.
Right. Again, none of what's going on excuses what happened. It's just that we are not humans that live in a vacuum. So it does affect it. It does cause it. It is, you know, a part of these humans who are making these terrible decisions and doing these terrible things. But it does take a long time, even for me to realize like, oh, Cassie's an unreliable narrator, because she's processing her own trauma in real time as she's telling this story to a detective. And I feel like that took me a minute to get. So I agree. You do have to go through the entire thing, which I get it can be hard. I do love a courtroom drama. I find it very interesting. I know there were some critiques that she didn't do a great job of the exact dynamics of what you could say or couldn't say in a court of law. But honestly, I don't give a shit about that. I'm like here for the drama, not to critique exactly what somebody said. I think it does wrap it up and you understand a lot more about their dynamics and how they got here by the end. But it's just a sad story all around.
This is, again, it's a tough book. It's a tough book to recommend. And it's a tough book to read. And I get, you know, if you've listened to the pod for a while, you know, I'm a fan of dark books. I don't mind a heavy read. And I understand that that's not for everybody. So if this was not for you, I totally hear you. And if this book was personally triggering, I totally also get that and respect that. And we're looking at these characters from multiple angles, obviously not excusing anything that any of the people in this book did.
Totally agree. The only people I recommended this book to, again, are people that I trust would tell me. If I'm like, here are the triggers. And they will be like, no, I'm not picking that up, or I think it's fine. And also, I think that it does help that it's a step back from it. But like, everyone that I recommended it to, I was like, okay, I know we've had these debates and discussions or have that relationship where I know that you'll be okay reading this. Read it and tell me what you think about it so I can kind of process what I'm feeling about it as well. It's easy to get looped into the controversy around books like this, though. When you're reading something on Goodreads And you're like, what are my opinions on this right after you read something? You're like, am I crazy? Am I right? Which side of this debate am I on? Should there be a debate? What do I want to do here? So I think it's helpful in books like this to talk about it out loud, kind of bring it to light, and then, you know, look at it a little bit more closely.
First of all, thank you, Erica and Katie, for having me. My name is Jillian Medoff, and I am a novelist. I also have a regular person's job. I've been doing both since I was 18. I started as an intern when I was a senior at Barnard, and I went into cosmetics marketing. And then at the same time, I was writing stories and at night and on the weekends. I mean, the idea of writing a novel was like beyond me. And I just continued to do both for the last 30 years. I'm actually 59, so I've been around a while. And I've seen a lot of changes in the course of publishing and, of course, in my own career. I mean, I've published 5 novels. And now I am a senior consultant at Siegel Benz, which we do management consulting and corporate communications for large employers. Well, small employers too, but mostly mostly corporate is what I focus on. And I am also working on my 6th novel. So thank you again for having me.
So exciting. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm busy.
You are busy.
But it's been something I've done. I've always done writing and working. And it's just been my part of my system since I was a kid, you know? So
it's got to be a nice balance to work and do writing for work, which is still kind of exercising those muscles, but in probably a little bit of a less pressure environment than actually writing your own novels. And it's like different kinds of writing. So I like the doing both of them because it's the same muscles but in different ways, which probably makes you a really strong writer at work and obviously in your novels.
Well, I think you learn to handle criticism in a way because when you're doing it for work, it doesn't feel as though you're opening a vein in the same way that you're doing that for writing fiction. And the other thing, too, is when you're writing for business, there's a certain brevity and you learn other skills that you can incorporate. They sort of complement each other. Although I don't do as much writing now as I do supervising and management client teams. So, but that too has its strengths and weaknesses, I guess.
Obviously this book deals with a couple of challenging topics, but the main challenging topic being the central plot is this sexual assault case with Billy that we're dealing with. And we know pretty much from the very beginning that we are going to be embedded on the accused side rather than the accuser's side. But even being on the accuser's side, on the accused side, we are still distanced from Billy, the potential perpetrator, narrated instead by his sort of sister, Cassie. So our first question for that is, why are we in Cassie's head? Why was it important for Cassie to tell this story and not Billy, for example?
Well, to be honest, the book to me is less of, I mean, it is about the trial, but it also is about coming into consciousness and coming of age. And so the thrust of the book was always going to be Cassie's perspective. And what it tracks is her coming into an awareness of not just the crime that has been perpetrated by Billy, you know, ostensibly alleged crime. Basically, she's telling you the story of two crimes, one that Billy might have committed and one that has been committed against her. And so I chose to look at this from the point of view, not necessarily of the alleged perpetrator, but from his sister, who has a different vantage point that's both very intimate, but also she wasn't there. So she's coming into the story with her own set of biases and suppositions and prejudices, much like the reader does.
Yeah, that's really interesting. We're going to talk more about Cassie's evolution into consciousness as well, because that is definitely a central part of this book. And how does Cassie's role as not being a biological child or sibling affect her point of view on the family and on this story that she's observing and the trial itself, I guess?
Well, one of the things that I was definitely interested in exploring from a creative standpoint was the feeling of being an outsider in your own family and what that means in terms of vulnerability and also loyalty. So, for instance, if you look at her perspective, she tells you, well, she tells the reader that she had to be a better daughter and a more loyal daughter than her brothers, who are biological children and therefore really can take almost for granted their place in the family. And I think sometimes when you have families, especially when there's something at stake, like a family business or wealth, or if there's an illness, each child gets messages from their parents about what it means to be responsible to the family unit. And they're all different. I mean, you ask a bunch of different kids what it was like to be in their family, and you'll get all different answers. And so I was really interested in what it was like to be Cassie in this family, where on one hand, she has her own money, so she's not necessarily dependent on them. Well, she is for a certain time, but money isn't everything. And I think that is her, I guess if she has one theme, it's that money isn't everything. And that you can be extremely wealthy, but you can also be starved for other types of, other types of wealth, if you will. You know what I mean? And I was really curious about what that would be like within this family that does have everything and yet is also bereft of other types of emotions and, you know.
Yeah, it's interesting that I think most people can relate to at least some part of their teenage years, even if they are part of their same biological family, of still feeling like an outsider, and then how that gets exacerbated as you grow up and sort of try and become your own person, which Cassie's also trying to do, is like establish herself in this PhD program and trying to make something of herself outside of the family, and then is getting pulled back in constantly. And sometimes, like, very intentionally, they're going and picking her up and bringing her back into the family. It's super interesting.
Yes.
How did you think about approaching a storyline that has such a heavy subject matter at its core?
Well, it's interesting because when I first started thinking about this family, there was a much larger scale. I mean, the book originally started as a upstairs downstairs set in a contemporary or luxury building in 2028. This is really set in 2028. But I was looking at like the Valmont, which is sort of like the Dakota or one of those iconic New York buildings. I was really interested in the relationship between the super wealthy people that live there and then the class of service people that, you know, wait on them. And so the first couple of iterations of the book were actually more of like a Downton Abbey type, where you have the interrelationship among the wealthy people and the doormen and the hairdressers. And it was too sprawling. I mean, I was definitely interested in Cassie and Eleanor, her mother, but it was originally a book about kidnapping. And so in the very, very first scene that I ever wrote, there's a young girl who's ferried away in a town car and the doorman is watching, and she lifts her hand from the back and he thinks, you know, she's waving goodbye, but then she never shows up at school. And it turns out she was being kidnapped, and he realized she was calling for help, or she was waving for help. And then that became an exploration of parenting. But there was always something about that family, Cassie and her mother, and because her mother is an heiress. And so over time, the cast was too sprawling, and I just delved deeply into this family for a couple of years. And then as I got to know more about what was happening, then it started to take shape, what exactly was going on in this family and what was tormenting Cassie. And so in the final version, she's 23. Her mother is not her biological mother, but she is an heiress. And her not biological father, Lawrence, is a very pivotal part of her growing up, and then her brothers too. But I also began to really look at this family system and what drove it and what it meant to be very, very wealthy and yet still wanting in so many ways.
It's interesting, and I love how authors often describe it this way, that they got to know the family, or the characters revealed things about themselves. So it also sounds like the story was sort of unfolding for you. One of the things one of our readers noted is that there are a lot of similarities with The Case Against Billy that resonate with the Brock Turner, Stanford Swimmer case and trial. How did you think about the similarities when you were writing the book, and how do you think about them now? And was that sort of an intentional choice?
It was intentional only in the sense that there were pieces of that case that really interested me. And one of them, I don't know if you remember, when the father, Brock Turner's father, was being interviewed, and he said something like, my son's life is ruined for 20 minutes of action. And that really haunted me. I'm like, what would go on in a family that would, what kind of entitlement would be in a family that a father would say that? Not just that his son's life was ruined, but that calling, one of a heinous crime 20 minutes of action. I'm like, there's something up there. And that's where I was like, you know what? This is interesting to me from a creative standpoint. I want to find out more. And I didn't use the same, the same structure. I took, it's almost as if Brock Turner's sister is telling the story, but it's not. I used it for my own ends, which, the book is fiction. And when I was first starting this book, I knew on one hand that it's problematic to start in 2020, 2022, a book saying something awful happened to Billy, and Billy is the ostensible rapist. I knew that. But I also knew that this is my fifth novel, and I've been at this for a long time. I have very serious editors and publishers and agents that, we took it very seriously. I looked at this from every angle, and it's like, I can't tell the same story that has been told. I don't want to. Which is that you have a very a sympathetic survivor and a demonized perpetrator, and then you follow that arc to some sort of resolution where everybody feels that justice has been served. There is no justice in this type of sexual assault. And I know myself, having grown up in America, I know what it is like for survivors. And I think that at this point in my career, to tell that same story would not be interesting to me. It would not lend itself to 5 or 7 years worth of work on one project. And so on one hand, I wanted to make the novel interesting for me to write, because I do have a regular job. I write the books I want to write that grow organically over time, as opposed to saying, oh, this is going to be about this. Like, I don't always know what the book is about until I start writing it and delving into it. And it's a very iterative process, and it takes a long time. So the book has to be something that I'm interested in, that I don't know much about, or that I do know a lot about, but there are things I don't know about what I know, right? None of my novels are safe in that I'm not going to tell the same story in the same way. I want to do it a bit more provocatively, largely because it's interesting to me. But honestly, I never thought that this book was going to have the polarizing effect that it did, or even spark the kind of conversation it did, because to me, it was such an interior story. And I know that when Cassie is telling the story, there's a lot of, you know, she's ruminating. She's talking about a couple of different things at once. She repeats herself. And this was all absolutely chosen. It's not like I didn't know what I was doing when I was writing it. I knew exactly what I was doing. But there was a reason for that too, that I won't get into until we talk about the spoilers of the book. But what I think the joke was on me in some ways, because I'm like, oh, people will see this and then they'll know, you know, it's my fifth book. She must know what she's doing. But you know, that's where you become sort of self, you know, deluded, because I'm not a brand name. I don't have a million followers. Most people, I'd say 80%, 90% of the people who read the book had no idea who I was. For all they knew, this was my first book and I just stepped into a big mess. But, and that makes me laugh too, because it's like, oh my God, like, get a hold of yourself. No one knows who you are. So a lot of people didn't step back and say, well, this is her fifth book. And she does sort of have a very conscientious publisher. I mean, it's kind of like everything that people have been railing about has been considered. It's not like I went into this blind, but I did have reasons for what I chose the way I wanted to write it. I chose the pieces and details that I wanted to give when I wanted to give them. And I think when you look at a piece of art or a story or a play or a movie, if it's not genre, I mean, if it's not like tropes that you've seen before, then I think sometimes you have to give the author a little bit more credit that there was some thoughtfulness that went into the way that the novel was considered. I read everything. I mean, I read a couple novels a week, and I read a lot of nonfiction. I'm just a reader, and I always have been. And I did not want to read the same old story that I'd heard a million times, even though it's comforting. It's very comforting to have a heroine or a survivor that you can relate to. And that it's also uplifting at the end when there's justice. But that's not real life. And at the point in my own experience is, you know, the only way to get closure is to find it in yourself, because you're not going to get it from the outside world. And I think going into this novel, there are enough trigger warnings that if it's not for you, trust that you don't want to read it. You know, I mean, I don't think that every book is going to be uplifting and sentimental and heartwarming. I think when you're trying to explore issues that have been around for a long time and not resolved, there are nuances about them that we are just now starting to come to as a culture and still don't even understand fully. And that's, again, I don't want to spoil anything for anybody who hasn't read the book, but I will say that sexual assault is a very nuanced issue. And for someone to survive it, the it's a spectrum of mental agony. And you start at the most basic level of what did I do to cause this? Because you're trying to make sense of something that makes no sense. And so on one hand, you could say, well, I shouldn't have worn that skirt. I shouldn't have gone to that party. Oh my God, why did I talk to that guy? To the very other end of the spectrum, which is like, I cannot stay in this reality. I am going to somehow make what is unforgivable and unfamiliar completely a place that I can live. And that's where it alters your reality, you know? And I wanted to deal with that spectrum. And again, you know, I am a novelist and I'm writing fiction. So on one hand, I know that the book has to be somewhat entertaining to at least keep you reading and the, you know, turning the pages and then. But at the same time, it has to have the true psychological underpinnings. And what does that mean? And what am I working with truly? I am working here with a young woman whose psyche has been, you know, bastardized from the time she was a child. So she is a broken human being. And I had to be very careful about approaching this. But I can tell you that I know intimately and intuitively how Cassie came to this understanding. But the reader and the community at large, the book readers, to do something and take on something so nuanced, it's always a gamble. And people will get it or they won't. But that doesn't mean they might not get it exactly when they read it, but maybe a few years later, or maybe 15 years later, or maybe 20 years later, you come to a different understanding of what you've read.
Right. That's kind of what I was thinking too, is like that the book, that books like this can kind of move or change the conversation. When I first read this book, I read it randomly. I can't remember where I got it, but read it randomly. I hadn't read any of your other works before. And I loved it, and I thought it was a new way to kind of process these stories that we do hear all the time. But I remember immediately I told a couple of my friends, I was like, all right, I need somebody else to read this because I need to process it with somebody. I'm not sure exactly how I feel about it, but I really want to discuss it because it is nuanced and there is more to it than just this is how you should feel coming out of this story, or this is whose side you're on or whatever. And like you said earlier, there is no justice in situations like this. And I think we are quick in society to decide that there's one, you know, it's like cancel culture, right? That there's one way forward. So I think you kind of answered this question, but I'm going to ask it again anyway, just because of the last part of it. So there are two ways that we as a society process stories involving rape or sexual assault, in my opinion. We either reject people who commit these crimes by saying that they're fully bad, they're beyond repair, we've kicked them out of society. No one that I know would ever do that, right? We fully distance them from the human part of us. Or in the case of rich white men like Billy, we overemphasize the human parts of them. He was a great athlete, he had so much potential, he loves his family. And so I think that obviously the conversation is a combination of these nuanced views. How do you think that your book, as polarizing or as not polarizing it has been, how do you want it to change or move this conversation as we continue to talk about sexual assault in the larger society?
Well, I think one of the ways is that there's no one way that we can talk about either rapists or survivors. Every situation has its own different characteristics. It has its own momentum. It has its own outcome. And I think that you're absolutely right, that there is sort of a way that we, either in the press or in our own minds, try to characterize people. But, you know, you're trying to make sense sometimes of a really heinous, very confusing act. And I'm not saying that, you know, rape is rape. I'm not saying that's not confusing. What's confusing is how the victim has to process it, you know? And in this case, I chose not to go into Diana Holly's perspective, which, you know, that was a choice, and it was a calculated choice. And whether that was the right choice or not, I'm not here to say, but I did want you to understand what it's like to be a victim or a survivor, from which is where, you know, Cassie's voice comes in. So she is sort of like not a stand-in, because Diana's experience is completely different. But, you know, I'm very interested in the mental, the way that a human mind processes violence. It's very interesting to me, because, and I said this before, it's like, how do you make sense of something that makes no sense? And it makes no sense when someone you love turns to violence. It makes no sense when an older person who supposedly has wisdom and insight, when they perpetrate violence, it makes no sense. And so how do you make sense of this as a victim, but also as a culture? I mean, how do we make sense of these nuances? And I think we're just coming to that, which is that, you know, I don't think in this book that there's a particular amount of sex. There's not a lot of sexual description. What there is, though, is a lot of power dynamics. I chose this particular family because I had actually started with the building. I mean, the family lived in the building, and that character came first. And then, you know, I went through a couple of discussions where, well, you know, what if they were a middle-class family? Or what if they were, you know, it just didn't fit. I mean, to me, the narrative and what I wanted to explore, especially the idea of personal bias and what you bring to a novel, they had to be wealthy, because people will come to that story with a very different perspective than if the family was impoverished, you know? I mean, our narrative is that the 1%, and in fact, I really wanted them to be even wealthier. I wanted them to be in the billions, and my editor's like, no, because that's a whole different level of, you know, it is true that the 1% holds, you know, 90% of the world's wealth. And I know that you asked this question, I saw it, about whether I was humanizing them or indicting them, right? And I don't think when you humanize someone, you necessarily make them likable. But I think what you do is that you make them understandable.
I also think it's part of why I appreciated this particular portrayal of sexual assault, is because I think it is much more realistic to how these things actually happen. And we have this sort of misperception that sexual assault is usually perpetrated by a stranger in an alley, someone you don't know, you're just walking down the street. And in my experience of having this, it looks a lot more like what happened with Billy. Like, it looks like, you know, people were drinking. It's confusing. It's someone you know. It's someone you dated. It's someone you're related to, a family friend, somebody that you trust. And that makes, yeah, you coming forward and even processing that it happened to you much more difficult, because you have to internally justify, well, this is a person that I love that I thought loved me, and they also did this thing. And how do I put those two pieces together? How does a jury put those two pieces together? And how does the public put those two pieces together? It gets much more complicated, but that's statistically much more realistic to what actually happens and why it's so difficult to actually get justice, like you were saying.
Yeah, I agree. I also, you know, I've been reading all about the Tennessee case, you know, the guys in Memphis. And because, you know, it's so sensational, and in the sense of like where this horrific crime was committed, and now they're releasing the tapes, and on one hand, it's like you don't want to look, but on the other hand, I want to look because I want to understand. I want to see. I can't not look. And when I see people and I hear people saying, why would you tell that story? It's because my story is because you have to. I mean, you have to look at all of the different angles to truly understand. Otherwise, we don't move forward as a culture. We get stuck in these black and white ideas of who people are. And I don't, you know, I think to evolve and to understand, then, you know, you have to look at some very uncomfortable things, and you have to be uncomfortable sometimes too.
I think we said that too, when we were talking about this book, like there is a want to not talk about the nuance of it and to just be like, I don't want to look at that. I don't want to discuss it. But how do you truly evolve without understanding how you got to where you're at and how you perpetuated this culture, et cetera? So I think it's an important discussion point. Okay, we're going to switch to the spoiled section. So if you have not finished the book, this is your chance to stop listening and go finish the book. So this first question in the spoiled section, we find out that Marcus is actually Lawrence, which was wild and totally changed how we felt about Cassie, the family, her reliability as a narrator, what had happened to her, etc. Can you talk a little bit about the Cassie Lawrence dynamic more and how it evolved as you were writing?
Sure. I knew after about 50 drafts, I knew that I knew really from pretty early on that Lawrence was a predator. And I also originally before I sold the book, he was revealed at the end of section two. So you went into the trial knowing that he was, he had abused her. But my editor was like, no, that's got to be a third act reveal. That's going to come later. And so that at that point, she had called him Marcus as a way of distancing herself and distancing the experience. Because again, how do you live your life with this duality as a 16 or a 14, 15 year old, and makes no sense. So you create this other reality that you can live in, and that it's not true, but it's true to you. And it's something that you can live with. And so she created this, you know, this different person almost. I'll be honest with you. He was revealed 100 pages earlier in my original draft, and I didn't have to lean into the Marcus thing so much, you know, like I didn't, because you didn't, I didn't need to use it as much. And then when and to me, honestly, I thought it was obvious. Like I thought it was obvious going into, by the second part, I figured, how could you not know? To me, it was so obvious. And so then I moved that reveal. And then there were parts where I had to, it had to make sense, right? Because this is where it became fiction. I mean, even more fiction, right? Where, how are you gonna, you have to orchestrate this. And I'm like, I didn't want it to be a gimmick. I mean, the idea of, oh no, it's the guy with the mask. I wanted it to be as true to life as possible. And so one of the things that is very true is the way that Cassie tells her story. And I could have cut maybe, you know, 50 pages from the first part. But the thing about being a victim is that it is so hard to tell your story. And you will constantly double check, you know, ask questions even of yourself. You'll tell a story and then double back and retell it in different ways. It's a really, really hard experience to talk about sexual assault. It's a crippling, crippling thing. And so what I wanted to do is it's essentially write two books. And the first book, if you don't know about the Lawrence Cassie, then it's just as if she's telling you this story and she's long-winded and she repeats herself. And why is she doing that? But then when you know and you go back and reread it, she's actually telling you the story of her and Lawrence. And in every scene, every piece of dialogue is, it's all double entendres. You can read it on a straightforward level, but then if you read it again, you realize she's telling you about Lawrence and he's standing right there and she's talking to him at the same time. And you start to see, oh, okay. So the book works on two different levels. And that's why it was more challenging for me as a writer. And that's why I tackled it that way, because I wanted to see if I could pull it off, really, which is a true authentic, a true and authentic portrait of some survivor telling her story. And, whether I did or not is not for me to say. I know that I'm comfortable with it. And, of course, in retrospect, there are things that I would always maybe tweak and everything, but it gutted me, this book, getting from point A to point B. And, I don't know that it's my most artful, but I know that it's my most true and most authentic in a lot of ways. And I think that when you come into it and you start reading it and you're expecting a psychological thriller, it's not that. That's not what this is, really. It's a family drama that, has a little bit more oomph to it and a little bit more and then to it. But you're reading about the breakdown of a family, that where violence is at its core, and how does that affect each of its members, and how do they all live with it and at the same time pretend that it's not happening? Even if they don't know it's happening, you got to know something is going on, right? And so you create these entire mental gymnastics to try to account for something in your family that is just horrifying, And I don't think that lets any of them off the hook. I mean, I still think they're accountable, but I think that to understand it, again, helps a reader and then ultimately a culture tackle some really complicated stories,
Yeah, yeah. I totally agree. It's much more of a family drama and also a trial drama than you almost think. And also, one thing that Katie and I will probably talk about more is it is about a sexual assault case, but we don't actually watch it. Like you were saying, there's not a lot of, graphic descriptions of what happened as much as it's something that's like always in the corner or alluded to. And that almost provides that psychological thriller where you're always kind of wondering or trying to decipher from Cassie's memories what actually happened. But I do also want to talk about that other big spoiler, which is the result of the trial with Billy. And in the end, Billy is not found guilty. You already mentioned that you kind of, in your mind, are convinced that he did do it. But did you always know that you wanted it to end this way with him not being convicted? And why is that something that you wanted in the end?
I did know that he was not going to be convicted, although there were times when I questioned whether that would be a satisfying ending for readers. You know what I mean? Like, on one hand, you have the real life aspect of it, would he or wouldn't he? But then you also have the book as a form of entertainment or art or whatever, and a reader wants to walk away satisfied on some level, and that is very unsatisfying. Although I did make it clear from the beginning that the point of the trial was who was going to tell the better story, and not me as the novelist, but within which lawyer was going to prevail. And I think that that's another indictment to me of the very wealthy and how they can manipulate outcomes. In you want to believe, and I do want to believe, that the justice system is fair. And time after time, even in the Brock Turner case, where that judge said, you know, where he sentenced him to like 6 months and said, you know, basically like, we're not going to ruin his life. And it's like, you ruin someone else's life, right? I mean, and that was really unfair to me. But I did think that in this particular case, what we saw of the of Diana Holly was that she was used as a pawn, and they didn't do as good a job as Billy's team. You know, they knew how to get her to, I mean, you know, the whole thing to me is, in my estimation, other than Cassie, I think the best character is the lawyer, Di Fiore, right? Because you start and you see him and he's this schlubby guy. And remember, you're seeing everything through Cassie's perspective. And then by the end, you realize, oh my God, he knew everything from day one and she didn't see it. And so by the time he used her as a pawn in her brother's trial, I was like, oh my God, that's so unbelievably twisted. And yet a character like that, a man like that, a lawyer like that would absolutely do everything he could to win. And so I went with the way I went with it. And Diana on the stand did not come off as credible because she basically lied about the whole reason for the relationship, right? I mean, or for ending the relationship. I mean, she had walked in on Lawrence and Cassie. She'd seen what she'd seen. She went back and told Billy. He couldn't deal with it. And they broke up. And then over the course of their breaking up and getting back together and breaking up and getting back together, that was the thing that triggered him into just abject rage. And violence beyond anything that, I mean, he loved her, right? But this is like primal shit, you know?
I think in some way it was still satisfying, because if I would have read a book like this about Billy and he would have, you know, fully been convicted and gotten 15 years in prison and had this whole, you know, quote unquote justice is served, I wouldn't have believed it. And I would have been like, this isn't satisfying because that's not the world that we live in. And so there is something to be said for, like, yes, you could write a book where quote unquote justice is served, but it wouldn't actually help you to process the world that we actually live in. So I think there is something to be said for the satisfaction of it ending exactly how I felt like it was going to end, because of course Billy is not convicted. Of course that's how this story ends. I mean, that is how it continues to play out. So
I also think that, you know, there's a lot more to come for this family, and especially the relationship between, how do you repair a relationship between siblings like that? Like, on one hand, you know, what did you do with my father? And then on the other hand, it's like, what did my father do to you? It's like, this happens in families. I didn't just make this up. And I think that the in this case, Cassie is being held responsible for something that her surrogate father did, but that's true to life, you know? It really is. I mean, how many times have we heard about young girls being sexualized? They're too sexual. They're, you know what I mean? Or everything from being called sluts to, it just is horrifying to me. And this, and I wanted to show that this is a really extreme example of something really bad, but it's not, it does happen. It's not like I didn't just make it up. It does happen.
Okay. I think that's a perfect place to end. Thank you so much. We have one more question that we're going to spring on you because we forgot to put it in the outline, but we want to know, what else are you reading right now? And do you have any books that you would recommend to our listeners?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I read a book this summer that just I loved it. It's called Swimmers. I don't know if you've heard of it. Julie Osaka. And it's about a community pool. And the swimmers are identified by the lanes that they're in. And it's just, it's really about mothers and daughters and losing your mind. But it all takes place in this pool. And it's unbelievable. It's just a brilliant book. And I'm also halfway through Tomorrow, Tomorrow, and Tomorrow. And I really love it. I love it a lot. And
love
it.
Both of us.
And I just think she does such a great job to take a very arcane and not very accessible industry and make it open for all of us to understand in so many ways. In fact, I have three daughters. And so we share a lot of books and that's one that is like, you know, family book club. And Kindred. We're also reading Kindred.
That's so fun. I think Katie and I also do that with our moms. We'll like read a good book. Usually I'm like the filter for my mom of like, you'll like this book, you won't like that book, here, read this one, and then read that one and tell me when you get to the end. And yeah, it's a sweet way to connect with your mom and sisters.
I just gave my mom Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow this week as well. She was like, I don't like video games. I'm like, just trust me. You need to get into it. It's going to be fine. You don't have to like video games.
When I was growing up, I never thought that I was going to have kids just because, you know, in some ways, it's like when Cassie says, like, she didn't think she would live a normal life. I didn't think that I would live a normal life. And that's why I always had this job, because it was like a legitimate thing, like a person, like a real person will have a job. And then I met a guy and he had two daughters, and then we had another daughter, and it's been the greatest part of my life is you know, raising them. And now that they're readers, it's everything I've ever dreamed of, you know, is my weird novel shit. But sharing it with my kids is pretty amazing. So
that's so sweet.
Yes. Well, you guys have been so wonderful.
Yeah, this was so fun. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you for having me. Okay. Bye bye.
Oh no, Katie has no book updates.
I hate my life right now. I'm just like, this month. Ugh. Okay, don't hate it. I'm just like working 10 hours a day, and then I just can't. I can read for like 10 minutes where I physically fall asleep. My eyes are just like, can't do it today, kid. So anyways, I'm almost done with Spare, and I'm almost done with Seven Husbands of Evelyn Hugo. Also, Prince Harry. Please listen to this podcast and please tell me why this book is over 400 pages. It's not necessary. And also, who edited this book? I mean, I'm into it. I love it. But I just feel like we could have cut out 150 pages. We just could have. We should have.
I hear you.
What's up?
I won't be reading it.
Okay.
Well, I finished my fourth book of January just in the nick of time.
Oof.
I finished The Southern Book Club's Guide to Slaying Vampires by Grady Hendrix.
Was it gory?
Yes. It's so funny, again, to like read dark books, because I feel like when you get into a dark book, you're like, this is about to be dark. It's about to be heavy and gory and intense. This book is like, we're just some Southern gals who have a book club and we love our books. And then it's like vampire, murder, rape, like Jesus Christ, guys. It really comes out of nowhere. It's very intense. But it was cute. It's like basically the story of
But
these...
it was cute? But it was cute?
That's what's crazy. This guy is a crazy, creepy vampire guy who's like just like really gross. And the scenes of like him sucking the blood out of people is like really disgusting. And his like house is really gross. And there's like bugs and rats and murder. It's a lot. But at its core, it's a story of five housewives who have to sort of band together and try and defeat this vampire. And there's like race dynamics, class dynamics, missing and murdered Black children who are getting ignored by the media. There's like gender dynamics. So there was really a lot happening that I think kind of is a light touch almost in terms of the way the story is told. It's still sort of told from a lighthearted angle, but it is like kind of really intense. By kind of, I mean it is intense, but it's told so like easy breezy that I'm kind of like, oh, okay.
No prop, just and a casual murder and we're great. Moving on now. Bring wine to
so the rats tonight. The rats are eating people? Okay, cool.
Ooh. So do you think it was done well? Do you like it? What's like the rating? I can't tell.
I thought it was enjoyable. I'm going to give it a 3.5 out of 5. It was okay. Fine. It would be that's a very a... funny kind of campy movie if they made it into something like that. Okay. And at its core, it had really good messages. I think it's a nice light touch way to look at, yeah, race, class, gender, perception of housewives, husband-wife dynamics, the role of mothers, housewives in general, community even. There's a lot of deeper themes.
This reminded me also, while you're saying it, I don't think I'll read that book, but it reminded me of the play Six, which I saw this week, which is like campy and funny and addresses like miscarriage and beheadings and adultery, like all these like big themes in like concert form in a very campy way. And you're like, wait a minute. Who is this man again? What happened to these six women who married him, who he then just like casually murdered? But it's like in a lovely little concert. It's so much fun. You're like, I'm at a rock show. I'm standing up. I'm dancing. And, you know, it's like a light touch way of these super dark themes.
That's so funny. That's been on my list for a while. You liked it?
Highly recommend.
Then I got from the library Pachinko, which is by Min Jin Lee, which is the story of a Korean family through four generations. And I'm really liking it so far. I'm like 100 pages in.
I really wanted to read that.
It's good. It's another 600-page book. So save that one for a couple months from now when you're feeling better.
That's okay. I'm about to knock it out of the park on these plane rides, so it's going to be fine. I don't know if I'm going to read on vacation. I mean, I'm sure I'm going to read on vacation, but no pressure. But I'm going to definitely be reading on the planes. So, you know, I'm hoping to come back next week and tell y'all that I finished at least 4 books. And if I don't, just kick me off the podcast. Okay?
Well, I hate to break it to you, but we're not recording next week.
I'm going to say next time. Next time we record, I will have read 4 books. Next time.
Book Talk is made by me, Erica Bailey, and Katie Cheney, with production support from Dan White. Our theme music is by Dan White. We'll see you next week.
I feel like I'm losing my mind tonight. What was I just like? I am just like so tired. I'm like, am I alive? I feel like I need to write down everything I'm saying. I'm staring at the computer since 7 a.m. and I'm like, am I a human? Okay.